Joy One, the hits.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Ana Mateo. This program is for English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English. We may also explain words and language rules while bringing you stories and information from around the world. Today on the program, John Russell tells us about the dry conditions in the western part of the United States. For the Health and Lifestyle Report, I talk about improving the air quality in your home. Finally, we will end our 30 minutes together with Steve Ember and The Making of a Nation, our series on U.S. history. And now, John Russell tells about the dry conditions in the western part of the United States.
Two large lakes in the western United States have white rings around them. These circles show how sharply water levels are dropping. They are a warning that the 40 million people who use water from the Colorado River face a much drier future. The Colorado River supplies 7 U.S. states and Mexico. The 7 states are Colorado, Arizona, California, New Mexico, Nevada, Utah, and Wyoming. People use its water in large U.S. cities such as Denver, Las Vegas, and Phoenix. Colby Pellegrino is with the Southern Nevada Water Authority. He told the Associated Press, "The future of the river is going to be drier than the past. All the climate models and the current drought suggest that," he said. "Every sector is going to have to learn how to do more with less." Many laws and agreements govern the use of the Colorado River's water. In 1944, for example, the United States signed a treaty with Mexico to guide water sharing between the two countries. But even within the U.S., there are different agreements on how water is used. 22 tribes in the Colorado River Basin have water rights that have been confirmed by courts, notes the Congressional Research Service. These agreements allocate or divide and give out amounts of water. The Colorado River supplies enough water for 15% of total U.S. crop output and 13% of total livestock production. It also supplies Lake Mead and Lake Powell, the two largest man-made reservoirs in the United States. The U.S. Bureau of Reclamation oversees much of the Colorado River's water supplies. It recently released estimates that suggest Lake Powell and Lake Mead will drop 5 meters and 1.5 meters, respectively, by January 2021. The numbers are in comparison to water levels in January 2020. Even with the drop, Lake Mead's levels will likely stay above the point at which water cuts take place in Arizona and Nevada. In other words, officials will have more time to prepare for when such cuts may be necessary. Since 1990, the population of the Las Vegas area has more than tripled. Las Vegas gets nearly 90% of its water from the Colorado River. but the area has been able to use far less water than it is allocated. The Las Vegas area has done this by reusing almost all water used indoors and replacing nearly 790,000 square kilometers of grass with desert-friendly plants. In other areas, officials are working to find different water sources for growing cities and farms. In Arizona, where nearly 40% of the water supply comes from the Colorado River, officials need to find other water sources, notes Ted Cook of the Central Arizona Project. Once Lake Mead's water levels sink low enough, Arizona will have the most painful cuts of any state based on a priority list, first rural farmers, then eventually cities. It's at least a couple of decades until we're saying, "We don't have one more drop for the next person that comes here," he said. But people certainly ought to be aware that water is expensive and, with climate change, going to get even more expensive. I'm John Russell.
From VOA Learning English, this is the Health and Lifestyle Report. On Google, one of the most searched questions related to the coronavirus is, can it spread through the air? The answer, yes, it is possible. World Health Organization officials have said it is possible for COVID-19 to spread in the air under certain conditions. One of these conditions is poor indoor ventilation. Ventilation is the movement of air through a space, especially an indoor or enclosed space. We also describe ventilation as airflow. Experts say poor ventilation may help the coronavirus stay in the air longer. Fresh air, scientists note, break up virus droplets. And this reduces the chances of transmitting or spreading COVID-19. The Environmental Protection Agency in the United States says that good ventilation with outside air can help reduce airborne contaminants, including viruses, indoors. Such findings are changing safety requirements for workplaces. VOA Learning English recently wrote about this issue. But what about in our homes? What can we do to improve airflow where we live? The EPA website lists several ways to increase ventilation in our homes. It also states that, in general, the greater the number of people in an indoor environment, the greater the need for ventilation with outdoor air. Of course, opening windows and doors is one easy way to let in natural air. However, that may not be enough to increase natural ventilation indoors. If inside and outside temperatures are similar, and there is little wind, natural ventilation may be limited. You can get better airflow by opening windows or doors at different sides of the home. This is called cross-ventilation. Open the highest and lowest windows in a home at the same time. This can be especially helpful if the windows are on different floors in a building. If your windows open at the top and bottom, open the top of one window and the bottom of another. If you only have one window in a room, open both the top and bottom partway. This will increase airflow. However, experts warn not to open windows and doors that may cause other health risks. For example, do not open windows if they let in a lot of air pollution. And be sure not to open windows that a child could fall from. Fans are also an easy way to move air around. But simply putting one in the middle of a room might not be enough. Here are more suggestions from the EPA. Bathroom and kitchen fans are usually designed to blow out indoor air. This removes contaminants from the air. So turn on these fans if you have them when the room is in use. Or if possible, keep them running most of the time. Use portable fans, ones you can move around, with open doors or windows. A fan facing a window blows air out of a room. A fan placed away from a window draws air into a room. Also, you can use many fans, blowing air out of one window and drawing it in from another. If you only have one fan, it should blow air in the same direction that the air is naturally moving. However, to help reduce risks of airborne transmission, do not have the fans blowing directly from one person to another. When using fans, of course, be careful of small children. Keep them out of reach of little fingers. Also, make sure the fans will not fall over. The EPA website also suggests using window air conditioners that have an outdoor air intake. But it is important to know that some window air conditioners do not have outside air intakes. A home's heating, ventilation, and air conditioning system is called the HVAC system. HVAC filters and air cleaners are designed to remove pollutants or contaminants from air that passes through them. Experts say that air cleaning and filtration can help reduce airborne contaminants, including particles containing viruses. The EPA website says if your home's HVAC system has an outside air intake, open it. Experts advise you to closely look at your HVAC system's information. You may need an HVAC professional's help to make sure your system is running correctly. Sometimes ventilating with outdoor air is difficult. For some people, opening windows and doors is not possible because of high temperatures, pollution, or safety risks. In these cases, portable air cleaners may be helpful. Portable air cleaners and HVAC filters can reduce indoor air pollution, but they cannot remove all pollutants from the air. Experts remind us that improving ventilation is just one way to lower the risk to COVID-19. Ventilation should be used along with other best practices, suggested by health experts. These practices continue to be social distancing, wearing face masks, cleaning surfaces, and washing hands often. And that's the Health and Lifestyle Report. I'm Ana Mateo.
From VOA Learning English, this is The Making of a Nation, American History in Special English. I'm Steve Ember. We begin the story of a document that defined a nation, the United States Constitution. The 13 American colonies declared their independence from Britain in 1776. But they had to fight for that independence in a long war that followed. During that war, the states were united by an agreement called the Articles of Confederation. But the Union of 13 states was loosely organized. The Articles of Confederation created a weak central government. The document did not create courts or provide for a president or other executive to carry out laws. The Articles of Confederation did create a Congress, but that legislature had little power or money. When British General Charles Cornwallis surrendered at Yorktown, Virginia, a messenger brought the news to the Congress. But Congress could not even pay the messenger, so money had to be collected from each member. The war ended in 1783 with the Treaty of Paris. Even before then, three influential Americans had called for a change in this loose confederation of states. The three were George Washington, Alexander Hamilton, and James Madison. They urged the formation of a strong central government. George Washington commanded America's troops during the Revolution. He opposed the Articles of Confederation because they provided little support for his army. His soldiers struggled with shortages of food, warm clothing, shoes, and other supplies. Here is an actor playing George Washington in a show at the National Archives. He is talking about the Articles of Confederation.
In my mind, it prolonged the war by several years. Every time I needed men or money to prosecute the war, I had to go to 13 sovereign heads of state hat in hand. Even now, under peacetime conditions, we are like a giant with 13 heads tottering towards a cliff.
Alexander Hamilton was a young lawyer who served as an aide to General Washington during the Revolution. Hamilton called for a convention of the 13 states to create a new central government. He expressed his opinion in letters, speeches, and newspaper articles. Finally, there was James Madison. He was one of the authors of the state constitution in Virginia in 1776. When Madison, Hamilton, and Washington looked at the Articles of Confederation, they saw an unhappy picture. There were 13 governments that each tried to help themselves at the expense of the others. Each state had its own army. Nine states had their own navy. The states had these forces to protect themselves from each other. For example, Virginia passed a law which said it could seize ships that did not pay taxes to the state. Virginia did not mean ships from Great Britain or Spain. It meant ships from other states, like Maryland and Pennsylvania.
Basically, the thought was, we need a military defense structure, we need a modest army and a navy, we need to regulate trade with Europe, and individual states in a loose confederation won't do the job.
Akhil Reed Amar is a professor at Yale Law School. He says Americans realized a strong central government could improve their national security system. In 1786, representatives from Maryland and Virginia met to discuss opening land for new settlements along the Potomac River. The Potomac formed the border between those two states. The representatives agreed that the issue of settling new land was too big for just two states to decide. Someone asked, why not invite Delaware and Pennsylvania to help? Someone else said all the states should be invited. Then they could discuss all the problems that were giving the new nation so much trouble. The idea was accepted, and a convention was set for Annapolis, Maryland. The convention opened as planned, but it was not much of a meeting. Representatives came from only five states. The men who did meet at Annapolis, however, agreed that it was a beginning. They agreed, too, that a larger convention should be called. They appointed the representative from New York, Alexander Hamilton, to put the agreement in writing. So Hamilton sent a message to the legislature of each state. He called for a convention in Philadelphia in May of the next year, 1787. The purpose of the convention, he said, would be to write a constitution for the United States. The nation was new, but the idea of a constitution was not. Law professor Akhil Reed Amar explains that the earliest settlers had formed political agreements called compacts, charters, or corporations. These agreements developed into state constitutions.
And then, in 1787-88, the idea becomes to try to continentalize, to take on a much bigger scale this idea of a written constitution setting forth the rules for how people would govern themselves, what government could do and not do, what their powers would be, and what the limits would be.
Even so, he says, Americans were not sure about creating such a constitution. Amar says they were afraid a new central government might be as arrogant and out of touch as the King of England had been. However, most people slowly came to believe that a strong central government would protect their country better than the loose union of 13 states could. Many people also believed that a constitutional convention would not succeed without George Washington. People wanted to elect him president of the convention, but Washington did not want to go. He suffered from rheumatism. His mother and sister were sick. He needed to take care of business at Mount Vernon, his farm in Virginia. And he already said he was not interested in public office. George Washington was the most famous man in America. Suppose only a few states sent representatives to the convention. Suppose it failed. Would he look foolish? Two close friends, James Madison and Edmund Randolph urged George Washington to go to Philadelphia. He trusted them, so he said he would go as one of the representatives of Virginia. From that moment, it was clear the convention would be an important event. If George Washington would be there, it had to be important. The first delegate to arrive in Philadelphia for the convention was James Madison. Madison was 35 years old. He was short and losing his hair. He was not a good speaker, but he always knew what he wanted to say. He had read everything that had been published in English about governments, from the governments of ancient Greece to those of his own time. Madison believed the United States needed a strong central government that was more powerful than the 13 states. Madison also knew that he should not push his ideas too quickly, so he planned his work quietly. He came to the convention with hundreds of books and papers. He was prepared to answer any question about government that any other representative might ask him. Madison asked the other delegates from Virginia to also arrive early. He wanted to enter the convention with a plan for a strong central government. He was sure no other state would do this. Two Virginia delegates came early as requested. Together, the three men worked on Madison's plan. The only other delegates there were from Pennsylvania. Nobody seemed worried that there were no delegates from the other 11 states. After all, it took 2 weeks to ride a horse to Philadelphia from New Hampshire in the Northeast, and it took as long as 3 weeks to get to Philadelphia from Georgia in the South. Finally, the other delegates started coming, a few at a time. 55 men in all from 12 states. Pennsylvania sent the most delegates, 8. Rhode Island sent none. A few of the delegates were very old, but many were in their 20s or 30s. The average age of the delegates was just 43 years. From the moment the convention began, Madison kept careful records of everything everyone said. He never stopped writing. If it were not for James Madison, we would know little of what happened at that historic meeting in Philadelphia in 1787. Later, Madison explained how he did it. He wrote, "I sat in front of the president of the convention. All the other delegates were on my right and on my left. I could hear everything the president said. I could hear all the words of every delegate. I made notes only I could understand. Then, at night in my room, I wrote out completely all the speeches and acts. I attended the convention every day. I was there as long as the delegates were meeting and talking." James Madison's full records of the convention were not published until 30 years later.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. You can find more stories on the Learning English website at learningenglish.voanews.com. Thanks for joining us. I'm Ana Mateo.